1.
Our own mind has to be changed. We have to change our mind about ourselves.
In what way?
Our knowledge of self.
Ready to step up.
God support those that will support your vision and your direction.
A knowledge of self.
It's about being unapologetic and being powerful where it needs to be.
You want answers?
A knowledge of self.
You gotta believe God's strength gives us strength.
Yeah.
A knowledge of self.
I believe that your experience is your testimony.
Yes, sir.
Our own mind has to change. We have to change our
Yes, yes, yes. First of all, I want to say blessings to everybody. God bless. We want to welcome you and everyone listening to the sound of my voice to the Unconcealed Live Talk Show with yours truly, Naz, out of the New York, Jersey metro area. And big salute to, of course, Shadow Worlds Radio. And can't forget partners in, I'm not even saying crime, partners in God. But, you know, we just bring it to you straight and raw, the one and only Rebirth Public, you know, relations media. They holding us down. Much love to Simone and the team. Oh, my God. I want to say, first of all, I hope everybody having a blessed week. I hope you have taken the opportunity to think about what you go through. And I pray for those who's lost and those who are just going through struggle. I pray for you. I pray for you that you continue to have that drive, that blessing, that direction. You know, without, you know, vision, you know, you can't have action. So we want to make sure we send that inspiration to you guys. But today's show, we're going to have a good one. We're going to have a great one. So before I even bring on our guest, I want to first kind of do a little tidbit before I bring him on. Our guest is a legend, because on this show, we will empower, unapologetic empowerment. This gentleman is from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He's a co-founder of his nonprofit organization, Stop the Killing. He's a national community activist. This man goes hard for this community, the streets. He's a youth counselor that works at risk youth and stressed communities, especially our Black communities that have been victimized by violence, police abuse, or just oppressed. And he also has a publication of Stop the Killing. You know, I want to proudly bring on, without no further ado, the legend, the one and only Arthur Silky Slim Reed. Welcome, brother, to the show.
Hi, man. Thank you for having me, man.
Oh, brother, it's a blessing, man. You know, I just gave the listeners just a tidbit of you, man. You know, just before we kick it in, man, my thing is, first of all, you know, I try to have a dialogue with the guests, like just like two brothers just talking or just two people talking, having a conversation. And we just trying to keep it, you know, unscripted, just talking about life in general, because people just want to know who you are. So before I kind of kick the show off, you want to kind of let the listeners know a little bit about where you're from, who you are, and where you at to now.
Man, I'm from South Baton Rouge, Louisiana, man. I grew up in a place called The Bottom, where around 13, 14 years old, I actually started a gang that's become nationally known through rappers such as Lil Bootsy or Kevin Gates, Southside Record Crew, which referred to as Four Down. And I'm also a member of the Rolling 30 Crip Gang out of L.A., Los Angeles. So I come from a gang background for 33 years of my life, but for the past 20 years have been the most proud part of my life, because I've been after the gang members. I've been after the individuals that's causing record in the streets. I've been after those drive-by shooters to let them know that we have been fooled into a lifestyle that at the end of the day brings us to the graveyard of the penitentiary. You know, I tell people in urban communities there's 3 yards that a young Black man would definitely see: the front yard, the backyard, or the penitentiary yard. And the other yard that I always try to get them to avoid would be the graveyard. So those 4 yards are in a Black man's life that's growing up in the urban communities, because we haven't redirected those individuals' lives and let them live a lifestyle of death instead of living. And once I learn how to live, man, that's what I try to do every single day. I live to let others live, because basically I have lived the life of 5 men. I've been on all sides of the fence, so definitely I'm enjoying myself right now. helping to resurrect those that are in a spiritual death inside of the communities that we try to save.
That's what I'm talking about, brother. See, that's a tough testimony. Now, it's, when I say testimony, I'm not, you know, I'm not no, how you say, a religious heavy person, but I am spiritual. Your experiences enabled you to have a testimony, brother. And just going through your bio, going through your history, because I believe in research, I believe knowledge itself, you know, you got to educate yourself. And like you said, your experiences enabled you to help guide. I mean, because you come, first of all, you come from a real place of experience that a lot of people need to understand, you know, because a lot of times, you know, like I know, when you talk to some of our younger brothers and sisters, they're misguided, misdirected, and they thinking, okay, yeah, you know, I have this Teflon thing on me, you know, nothing's going to happen to me. But you've lived that life. Now, from my understanding, you've been through some life situations. You know, I don't want to go too deep in your past. I want to definitely talk about how you overcame those challenges. I think that's where we're at. I know we talk behind the scenes. We want to make sure we understand the past, but understand the present and where we're going forward with you. You, my understanding, you was shot. I also understand you had a life-death situation that changed you. Was those moments pivotal in your transformation to who you are now?
Well, the life situation, the wreck I know you're referring to, definitely changed my life. But me getting shot, the 12 times that I have been shot, know that it changed my life, because I was actually, I guess you can say I was insane. And it was to a point where we could be together and someone shot us down and you died and I lived. And I would sit in the funeral and wonder, man, I don't know, what something he ain't tapped into. I actually thought that I couldn't die. I thought that I was invincible. I thought that I couldn't die because everybody around me was dying, you know. And I was sitting there and I was like, I don't know, I think I got this figured out, you know. I think that as long as you have the will to live, you will live. That's how crazy I was thinking, you know. And wow. I'm glad that I was thinking that way, because maybe that is what happened here. But I know that it's all God's plan, you know. When it comes down to the wreck and my life being saved through that, I was in Louisiana. Some of my gang members called and said that we needed to make a run to L.A. And, of course, you know, we were going to get drugs. I said, cool. I'm at my mom's house. So they came, called the house phone, because, you know, cell phones wasn't that hot. So they called the house phone. I got up, I packed my bag. I told my mom I'd see her later, and I went and got in the truck. But when I got in the truck, just like I'm talking to you, a voice was in my head, and that voice told me, go kiss your mom. You ain't going to see your mom again. I was like, damn, where that came from? I got out, went back to the door. I said, Mom, give me a kiss. I'll see you later. She said, I hope so, baby. I got in the truck, and we drove off, got on the interstate. We got from Louisiana to El Paso, Texas, and I wanted something to eat. I said, man, let me grab something to eat. We got off the bridge, and we got down to the bottom of the exit, and when we stopped at the stop sign, that voice came back again and said, look at that billboard. I looked out the window, and I looked at the billboard. It was a real car that had actually been in an accident. And at the bottom of it, it was all crushed up, but at the bottom, it had the words, everyone wore a seatbelt and everyone lived. I had never worn a seatbelt in my life, but something made me put that seatbelt on. I was like, wow. And I was telling them, you know, because we stopped, got out and looked at the sign. I was like, man, stop. Let's get out. Look at this. I said, look what it's saying. You know, I'm reading it. I got back in the van. I got back in the Tahoe, put the seatbelt on. And my boys was like, man, you let that sign scare you? I was like, yeah, man. I say, something told me to look at the sign. They took it as a joke. Oh, you getting weak. You getting pee. You getting pee. You getting weak. Boy, we ain't never seen you get scared of nothing. And we got on the highway, kept on driving. We went to L.A., stayed there for a week. We partied, got the drugs, shipped them back. And we got back on the highway January the 11th. I'll never forget. We got back on that highway, and we traveled. And we got to a place called Kerrville, Texas, which is right outside of San Antonio. And when we got there, you know, it was kind of cold in the mountains, even though we had the heater on. I was like, man, I'm cold. Give me the blanket. And I got that blanket, and I let that seat back, and I covered up with that blanket. And I had taken my seatbelt off. That voice came back again. Say, put it back on, look outside. And I said, man, I might be losing my damn mind because I ain't never went through nothing like this. So I looked out the window, and it was drizzling. And I looked over at the speedometer, and it was 77 miles an hour that we were traveling. I said, wow, man, slow down, man. It's raining outside. And my friend said, man, I ain't got time for that. And he was cursing. And he said, I got to get back and pay my income tax. And I put that seatbelt back on, and instantly an 18-wheeler crossed the line and hit the front of the Tahoe and knocked us over the side of the mountain. Everyone died in an accident except me. And when I climbed out of that Tahoe, the first thing I heard was that same voice say, I brought you out of that. I knew you were going to do something. And, you know, you can hear the voice and you can believe that it's God. I'm at war with a couple of individuals that actually sell people on getting saved in one day. You know, we go to church, we come back home, and we join church. I got saved today. No, you didn't. You started to acknowledge that you need to clear your life up today because it's impossible to instantly get saved. And I know that I had just gotten saved from a death experience, but my mind was still wicked. I'm in the middle of the desert. My friends are dying. There's no one out there. One white guy stopped and asked me what happened. And I told him, and he drove off, but I thought he was leaving. But he just went to get the mile marker. He went to go get the mile marker number and call the authorities, but it taken them a whole hour to get out into the desert where we were. So in between that time, the devil started speaking to me, too. God was already talking to me, but the devil started speaking, too. The devil said, you know, Al got $10,000 in his pocket that y'all ain't spending. I climbed back in that wreckage and all amongst all that blood and got the money because I didn't want the police to just come up on $10,000 or the undertaker to come up on $10,000. So I went back in and got the money, but it shows you that God could be dealing with you, but the devil will step in, too. So
that's
the
weakness
of the mind, man, that we have to start to control. I tell people every day when people ask me, well, how you doing? I'm doing fine, man. The only hell that I'm in is the one I put myself in. Because it's that devil inside of us that we got to learn to control before we even worry about one that's supposed to be under the ground somewhere.
Anyway,
I was saved by that.
Yes, sir.
I was saved. And, you know, I went to the funeral. And, of course, you know, it turned into a major ordeal in my life because the family members of the individuals that had died actually started to believe that I had set the wreck up. And, you know, that's what kind of I was, a slimy type of person in the streets. And they called the state troopers and told them, oh, he did that because they was on the drug run. They investigated. No way he would have known he was going to live. They said, that's impossible, you know. So that went away. I went to the funerals. I ended up going to the funerals. And, you know, I was so saddened by the deaths. And then I just decided to, you know, just stay at home for a minute. Because I didn't want to get killed in the process of them thinking that I had done something wrong. And I did go under the drugs, of course, because it was our drugs and everybody, you know, I'm not going to just give stuff away to family members to be nice. It was my drugs now.
Yeah.
You know? Everybody
knows.
I went fishing, man. And I went fishing. And when I went fishing, you know, I caught a very small fish and I took the hook out of his mouth and threw him back into the water. And that fish started flopping on top of the water. I watched my friends take their last breath out there in that wreck. And I had seen that. And I'm looking at this fish fighting for his life. And I became very sad. And then I started to cry. And I said a prayer.
Wow.
I asked God to not let the fish die because, you know, I just seen my friends die. I don't want to see anything else die. Lord, please don't let this fish die. That voice came back and said, watch the glory of the Lord. So I'm watching the fish. And the fish doesn't swim into the water. It just keeps flopping. I got mad and broke my fishing pole. Say, damn, I thought I heard the Lord talking to me again. And out of nowhere, one of those white birds that you always see hanging around water came and swooped the fish up out the water and took it off. And I say, wow. I say, Lord, that was a good one. Fed the hungry bird so it didn't go to waste. Thank you, Lord. And he say, how can I have so much? And that voice came back and say, how can you have so much mercy on my smallest creature, yet go out and try to kill my greatest, which is man, every day? And I put my gun down that day, and I never picked it back up. I started this mission, and I've been on this mission for 19 years now, doing the exact same thing, trying to save the greatest of God's creation, which is man. So that's how that happened.
Oh, see, amen, brother. See, that's what I'm talking about. You know, people don't understand the journey of a people. They look at you, or they see an image, but they don't understand the history, how it came about. And I think it's so incredibly important that people understand a person, who they are as a core. When I say core, what made that person to who they are, what their journey came to them. You're not, you're not out here just doing it to be doing it for some gratification or some pat on the back or trying to be famous. You have a genuine testimony and experience that you must deal with, and you are dealing with, man. And first of all, brother, I got to salute you. You know, what you've gone through and these signs and things that you've been blessed upon to make your moves is definitely a testimony, man. And brother, we need your story. That's why when I, you know, when me and my producer behind the scenes, Simone, you know, we've been talking about it, and she brought, you know, you to me, and I read the bio, and I just read more about it, and I said, okay, I know this man. I've seen him before. And I said, you know what? We have to, as a community, work together to have the like minds to help our people, you know, in the hood, the at-risk, those who's confused. Because in the next question I want to ask you, when I say confused, you was in such a dark place, and we have a lot of young people, and I know you know this already, you know, those who's influenced with the streets, the gangs, so even those who's not even influenced with that, but just have this dark mental place, because they may have been affected by maybe child abuse, drugs, poverty. How can we help those? Where do we start to try to help those? Because we damn sure have a lot of them living in these communities that's being threatened all the time, you know, with police violence, black-on-black crime, you know, oppression, you know, just a lack of jobs and opportunities. How do we help those? Because we have listeners that do listen to this show that, you know, they're from the streets or those who are just confused. Where do we start?
You know, if you go back, man, and you research well, I was on Bishop T.D. Jakes' show, and he was asking me a question similar to what you're asking. He said, Silky, I'm not from the streets. I need you to help me with this. What is it that I can do? And my answer to him was, anything that you do is more than what you're doing now, which is nothing. So individuals have to do something. As long as you're doing something to change around you and change the individuals that are around you, that's where it counts at. So many people try to put together strategic plans and follow through on those plans. So if you just go out there and start helping individuals to realize, the biggest thing that someone in the streets needs to know is that somebody cares. They don't care about how much you know. They care about how much you care. And once they find out that you care, then they'll listen to what you know. Our problem is that we always want people to know what we know, and those individuals are not even ready to digest anything because don't nobody care. They look at you as another hustler coming in to hustle off of them and make money off of them and be a social worker off of them. And that's one of the things that I always realize, that if I don't know how much you care, I don't give a damn about how much you know, because I know I'm a commodity out here. I knew that people was trying to look at gangs and study gangs in order to go to social work schools and do things to try to help the community. But once I started really analyzing and searching what was going on in the community, half of the problems that we see are socially engineered problems. And I was working for a college, and I was doing work in the street, and I was bringing in a lot of gang members and a lot of individuals turning their lives around. And once I started doing that, the assistant director of the college, the School of Social Workers, called me in and had a talk with me. He was like, hey, man, I love what you're doing, but I think that you're working against yourself. I said, what do you mean? He said, if you found an older house in your neighborhood that could be repaired and brought back up to good standards and that you could sell it, what would you do? Would you tear it down or would you repair it? Would you remodel it? I said, I would remodel it, of course. He said, yeah. He said, that's what this is. He said, you can't just go out there and tear down the problem, because once you tear down the problem, you no longer have a job. He said, you have to always be found remodeling. Do a little bit here, move on, do a little bit of. So they really wasn't into turning gang members around. They were into fixing small problems so that they could get the next grant. And once you realize that these are socially engineered problems, it makes you kind of bitter. And that's the reason that I have been outspoken the way that I have. And I have been going full force against some of these entities that create these problems is because I realized that this is real. And the only way that you find out that it is real is once you get inside. So some people go inside to try to make sure they have a seat at the table. I try to go in and turn the damn table upside down because I know that it's so much wickedness that's going on.
Yeah. Man, you know, it's as you're talking, I can't help but I look at it like yourself, but it almost sounds like a lot of these socialization agencies and like that gentleman we'll talk to you about, they sound like hustlers and drug dealers.
Hold
I mean,
up.
What's the cliche? You don't, you know, you give them tasters just to get them out there and to keep them coming, keep them fiending, you know, to keep that work going.
Definitely.
You know, yeah, so these selling hustlers, I mean, and drug dealers to me. You know what I'm saying? That's what I'm getting.
That's what it is. It's a hustle. It's all a hustle. And I tell people, you know, that once you see that it is a hustle, then you have to find your niche to try to undo the whole situation. When you, man, a lot of things are hustle, and a lot of people don't want you to bring those things out to the forefront. The biggest hustle in the world, and it has been for a minute, is the hustle of church. You got individuals in the church that's pimping, individuals that's trying to go and get the word of God, you know. So until we get some of the pimps out the pulpit, we're going to continue to be lost spiritually. When you start talking about people pimping in the pulpits, a lot of people get upset, and I'm saying, no, that's not any disrespect to a real pastor. That's letting you know that they got something that's out there acting like pastors. And there was a group of pastors that we was on the same program, and they told the people that if I spoke, they didn't want to speak. And the people asked him why. They said, because he's at war with pastors. And when I opened up in my speech, I say, pastors didn't want me to speak because they say I'm at war with pastors. I say, I'm not. I'm at war with Satan, and it's not my fault that he has disguised himself to look like pastors in his last day. I say, it's in the book, because the book tells you that they will have a hireling and a good shepherd. The good shepherd will give his life for the people. The hireling will run off. And they say, woe to the shepherd that feeds himself and not the flock. So if you see someone and you're going to church every Sunday and the preacher living better than you, something is wrong with that, you know. So I tell people, just be aware of how you're being led and who's leading you, because there are definitely some imposters out there in this day and age. They got some wolves in sheep clothing that's taking up these people's lives. And a lot of people, well, what church do you go to? Well, I'm on the road so much I can't go to church too much. But I also found it very self-gratifying to say that I will not go sit in a church for 2 hours and listen to a word to save me from a hell after I die, and then get up and walk outside and open the doors of the church and walk outside into a hell that I got the power to change. So I'm outside of the doors of the church changing that hell that's surrounding us. You know, we in church all day, brother, and then when we walk outside of the doors of the church, we walk into a hell. And just speaking of that, I have to share this story because I think God just put it in my spirit. The church really doesn't know how much power that it has. In the late 90s, I was selling a lot of drugs. I was in the gang culture, but I always lived in a very, very affluent neighborhood. And one time I moved into this neighborhood, and there was this mega pastor that always is on TV. Me and him became kind of cool, and he would stop and talk to me, and I would tell him that I was in the music business, and, you know, just to keep him out of my business, I told him I was in the music business, so he wouldn't have to try to figure out how I could afford the house that I was living in. And one day, him and his church was doing some things, and this pastor spotted me in the project, and I think, I'm not sure, but I was told that he asked somebody who I was, and they said, oh, that's the leader. And once he found that out, he realized that I stayed in his community. And I was at home one Saturday, and I was watching 60 Minutes, and I heard some noise outside of my house. And I said, wait a minute. And I had my house set up to when you come close to the sidewalk, it would alert me with a flashing light inside. So I grabbed my pistol, and I ran to the window to see what it was. And when I looked outside, he had about 100 to 200 members out in front of my house with candles, and the sun was going down, and they had a drum, and they was beating the drum, and they was singing a song. Satan, we're going to tear your kingdom down. You've been building your kingdom all over this land. Satan, we're going to tear your kingdom down. And that scared the hell out of me. But it also let me know one thing. I was no longer in the darkness in his community. And he brought that to my house to run me out of my house and get him, his family safe again. And I ended up putting the house up for sale, moving. So that's what the church has to do, form the full body of Christ and go into these communities and put them on alert. And I think the pastors are so scared. Oh, some people will kill you. But if you got the full body of armor of God on, you don't worry about death. You try to remove those evil spirits. It worked with me, and it will work with others. The church just doesn't realize how much power it has.
That's right. That's right, brother. A strong story, strong testimony. Now, you know, when we have churches, I mean, I'm going to get, before we get into where, you know, a little bit more about what you're doing now, we have churches, and I'm glad you brought that up. We have churches in various communities all over, you know, north, south, east, west. Is there any maybe ideas or things that we could bring on this platform that we could try to get them to kind of get away from their traditional stance of how they do with things and kind of get back into the community? Not so much preaching to the hood, but kind of you got to relate to, like you said, you got to relate to the people in the community in the hood. Those who maybe not be of God or those who just lost in their way. I mean, how can we kind of change that or maybe start that process? Because I'm down for that when I talk to fellow brothers or fellow sisters, you know, who maybe is having the church and try to get them come talk to our young people or maybe those in the hood or the community. How can we do that? Because you said they have a lot of power. How can we do that without kind of scaring people away from God?
Man, I'm a very spiritual person, and I read the books diligently. And inside of the book tells you that you have to go after those individuals that's out there in the highways and the byways. So what the church has to do is come out of the four walls, put the church in them, and go into the communities and start working with these individuals. You know, the problem right now, you know, everywhere I go and different shows that I come on, everybody's concerned about the youth. You know, man, what is wrong with the youth? Look like the devil got the youth. What's wrong with the youth? And it's not the youth that's the problem. It's the first three letters of the word youth that's the problem. What's wrong with the Y-O-U? What's wrong with you if you're not outside of the church trying to save those individuals? What's wrong with you if you're preaching a word that you're not living up to? What's wrong with you if you see an individual going astray and you're not trying to correct them? What's wrong with you is the biggest thing that we have to deal with. What is the matter with us as adults that we're letting our youth go astray? So the church has to get real with what they're doing. And at the end of the day, man, people always try to say, well, this world, let me tell you why we have the problem that we have in this world. It's because everybody is after the crown and nobody wants to carry the cross. You have to carry the cross. Without carrying the cross, there is no crown. So to put it in the scripture says it perfectly. It says that the laborers, you know, there's plenty of fruit out there, but the laborers are few. And that's what we're seeing. You know, the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. So that same fruit that we see out there is now spoiling and getting killed and run over in the streets. So the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. And that's it. I want you to get your pens and paper out for this one, that the problem of the world today is that Jesus, Allah, Yahweh, Jehovah, whatever name you call God, he has too many worshipers and not enough workers. Everybody's worshiping him. When you go to church, everybody's praising him, but he don't have the workers that he needs. So Jesus, God, Allah, Yahweh, whatever name you call him, Jehovah, you know, he has too many worshipers, not enough workers. And the thing is that even Jesus said it. Jesus said that, Master, what must I do to inherit the kingdom? He said, look, put all of that aside. Put all the worldly stuff aside. Pick up your cross and what? Follow me. Well, where are we going? Got some work to do. We got to go save some souls. Right now, the only thing that we're doing is worshiping and praising, but no work. No work. After church, you ain't got no assignment after church. When you leave church, you get in your car and you continue that same old entertainment. You know, and there's a story, man, because I have a lot. But there was a guy that actually wanted to become a preacher, and he couldn't find a building. And his brother said, look, I got a nightclub. you can use the nightclub on Sunday mornings because we don't open on Sunday. Just make sure y'all get it back straight so we can be back in business on Monday. And he said, oh, that's fine. Now, one Saturday night, one of the patrons got drunk and fell asleep in the stall. And Sunday morning, he heard that organ out there playing. He heard the drums playing. And he came out of the bathroom, and he started dancing in church. And the preacher man seen him say, hey, what's the matter with you dancing like that? He said, this is a club, man. He said, no, it's church in here today. It's Sunday morning. It ain't no Saturday. You must have been in there sleep. He said, man, I must have fell asleep in there. He said, now you can either sit down and get the word of God in you, or you can leave. He said, well, I'm going to leave, Pastor. He said, well, why wouldn't you want to get the word of God in you? He said, because half of these people that's in here today was in here last night.
What?
See, that's what we allow. We allow church to be a continuation of Saturday night's entertainment, man. And we have to stop that. So you see people coming in church all the time putting mints in their mouth. Why? They've been out drinking Saturday night. We gotta stop being a 6 day sinner Sunday morning Holy Ghost. For 6 days, we go out there and do everything we want and then come serve God on Sunday. We got to start living a godly life every day, and that's what we're going to change the hell that we're in, man. Go ahead.
That's right. I love that story. I love that one. You know, I got something I chop it up when I talk to a lot of the, you know, just people in general that I deal with, from helping them, whether they're young, old, or teenagers. You know, because I deal with a lot of the teenagers, those I call it, like the young adults. I deal with a lot of them at work. And, you know, when they talk about the one thing, they talk about consistency. They don't like social media. Mm-hmm. They don't care for them. They can tell within the first 2-3 minutes, they can feel you real. You know, you got the brothers, and then I'm going to lead into that. You have the brothers, you know, whatever. They made decisions, and they ended up incarcerated. You know, no systems in place for them when they come out of incarceration. And they have to deal with that challenge on top of finding high housing, on top of trying to find, you know, the mental health aspect, because people understand, you know, we incarcerate our brothers, but that's a whole other conversation, you know, disparity in how black men or people of color are locked up. And I talk about that because you had a publication of Corrections. And I did my research. I said, okay, that right there is needed. And I know that it's something passionate that comes from you. And I need to get my hand on that publication because I want to share it on my level. I want to share that, brother. Because it's needed.
It's an idiot, guys, man.
I just wanted to share that to the part book, of the story, brother. I asked you.
Yeah, man. You kind of touched me with that, because the book is actually, it's like an idiot, guys. It's what I did every single day when I was released from prison. And, you know, it's strange. You know, I went to prison at 16 years old, and I share my story very often. I'm a young adult, 16 years old. I'm sentenced to adult prison, and I had to learn how to survive in prison. One of the things that I tell people, before I went to prison, I went to reform school. And when I was in reform school, you know, all of this is a part of the Department of Corrections, right? When I went to reform school, I can remember very young, maybe I was 12 or 13 years old, I got in a fight, and I was ducking my head in the fight. And when the fight was over, the correction officer set me down, and he was talking to me. He said, say Slim. I said, yeah. I said, I ain't do as good as I want to. He said, yeah, man. He said, but you ain't lose, but you ain't win either. He said, you got to stop ducking your head. He said, you can't go up that road up there ducking your head, because you'll get a man, bro. He said, you got to start fighting with your head up. Now, my point is that here's a correction officer. Instead of correcting me and telling me that I didn't need to be fighting, he was telling me how to fight and survive adult prison, somewhere that I didn't have to go. But I guess in his mind, this Negro going to penitentiary. And you don't want to go to penitentiary fighting like this. People that go to penitentiary fighting like this, they get a man. And it made me more skillful in fighting. But if he would have corrected me, that could have been my one stop right there at the juvenile facility. I would have never went to an adult facility if he would have told me, you don't want to be in here fighting like this. There's a better place out there for you than fighting. He was telling me about going on to penitentiary. So corrections is what individuals need. And we have so many people that's fallen into that generational curse of going from correction facility, to facility, And that creates the revolving door now. Once I went to adult prison, of course, I'm young. I'm in the cell. Every day I'm jumping down out the bunk. I'll get the newspaper and look at it. And one day, my cellmate seen me, and he said, "Hey, man, what was in the paper?" I said, "Somebody got killed." He said, "Where?" I said, "I forgot." I said, "You want the paper?" He said, "Nah, read it to me. Check it out." And I teared up, and he said, "Yeah." He said, "You just like me." He said, "I came here at 16 years old. He said, "I'm 66 now." He said, "Your dumb ass going to be in here for the rest of your life because all you do is go in there and you watch BET and you watch those raps and you watch rap videos all day. You play dominoes and spades all day." He said, "Your ass ain't trying to go nowhere." He said, "You're going to be caught in the system." He said, "I'm in Dome 5 right now." He said, "I started off in Dome 1. He said, "What's in Dome 1? I said, "Youngsters." He said, "Then it's Dome 2. You get a little older." He said, "In 10 years, they move you to Dome 3. He said, "And he say, eventually, you're going to end up in Dome 5, where you start out at, because this is for young and tenders." He said, "So they put you over here where the old folks at until they feel like you can make it on the big yard." He said, "You're going to be out here all your damn life." And that man taught me how to read. And when the lights would go off, we would roll toilet paper and put Crown Royal grease on and light it with a lighter and use that as a wick so that he could teach me how to read. And he taught me how to read, and I started studying law, and I started studying things. But the thing that really interested me the most was slavery. And I started reading about slavery. And I'm not going to lie, one day they was working me in the field, man, and they was working, you know, hard work, and I was hiding behind some soybean trees, and I was looking for the free man. And the free man rolled up on me on the horse behind me, and he put a gun to the back of my head, and he said, "Reed, if I catch you not working again, I'll put a hole in you in the state to raise my pay." And when I turned around on the ground and looked up at him on that horse, it reminded me of a scene from Roots. And I seen that towel hanging from up under his hat, and he just looked it like the slave master to me. And it was a light that came on in my head, and I went on the penitentiary walk and started telling all my friends, "Hey, man, we in slavery, bro. We in slavery." They didn't say I was right. You know what they say? "Man, the white folks can drove that Negro crazy. Talking about we in slavery."
Yeah.
Anytime you working 12 hours a day, you getting paid. You getting paid 12 cents a day. You getting paid a penny an hour. I'm like, man, if this ain't slavery, what is? But it's not slavery mentality.
No.
Man, say, when I woke up to that, man, look, I woke up to that, and I never went back. And, you know, it was one person that I always thank God for. He was an old white man that worked in the prison. And he would see how other guards would let me lay out and, you know, act like I was working. But he would work the hell out of me. I can remember one visiting Sunday. I was standing on the walk waiting on my mom to come. And he said, "Reed, I got something for you to do." I said, "Man, my visit coming." He said, "If you don't do it, they call it disobeying a direct order. That's 90 days in the hole." I said, "All right." He was walking in the mud, and I was trying to walk on the sidewalk. He said, "Reed, you got to get over here where I'm at." I said, "Man, I got my brand new tennis on." "Reed, if you don't do it, it's disobeying a direct order." Anyway, he worked the hell out of me while I was in prison. And when it came time for me to go, Sergeant Thompson walked me to the door, and he stuck the key in the inside of the big gate, and he stopped, pulled his hat off. He said, "Boy, Reed, we done had some times, haven't we?" I said, "Yes, Sergeant Thomas, you showed me the blues." He said, "But I'll be here when you get back, Reed." I said, "Sergeant Thomas, I'm not coming back." He said, "Reed, you've been here half your life. This is all you know. I'll see you when you get back." I went back, and I was speaking, and I looked in the corner, and there he was. I said, "Sergeant Thomas, I owe you an apology. I said, I told you I'd never come back to prison. I said, I'm back tonight, but I'm going back home because this is my new life." He didn't say, "Reed, you proved me wrong." You know what he say? "So far, Reed, you're proving me wrong. Just keep proving me wrong." Like, he got that mentality. "You out there doing that, but I still think you're coming back. I think what you're doing going to get you back. I think they're going to get you caught up in a fraud charge." So some people will never believe in you, but the main thing you have to do is believe in yourself.
There you go. That's what I'm talking about, bro. Hey, that's what I'm talking about, bro. That's what I'm talking about. You know, your vision was with action, man. Oh man, you got me inspired, brother. You know, not just inspired, but you helped me validate what I do, and it feels good to know there's other like minds out here in this struggle doing what we need to do and must do for our community at the end of the day. Now, I definitely want to swing it over to what you're doing now, man. What you're doing now, you're a community activist. Can we talk about Stop the Killing? What is the nonprofit organization you have, Stop the Killing?
Well, it goes back to prison with that. And that's one of the things that I heard you when you asked the question about brothers coming home and how are they going to stay out and how do they... You have to realize that once you come home, number one, you got an X on your back, right? The biggest failure is coming home looking for a job. Spend that time that you're spending in prison starting your company, starting your organization, starting a way that you don't have to ask somebody to give you a paycheck. You get out and make your own paycheck. You've been working in the field for the past 12 or 15 or 20 years. Go home and start your lawn service company, you know? So if you have that mindset, you can be you can come home and be successful off top. Stop the Killing was a dream child of mine inside of the prison. When I was just like, hey, I need to do this, I need to do that. And once I got my life together, that's what I started to do. I formed Stop the Killing. And we have been successful in doing what we're doing for 19 years now. One of the things, and I want to share this with people, man, because I want people to understand something. My experiences are mine. I was in a 5x7 cell, which is a solitary confinement cell. And I had an appeal in to go home. And I was laying in my bed, and I became stuck to the bed. I couldn't get up. I tried to. I just couldn't. And all kind of famous people popped in my head. Bam, 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 bam. It was like a movie. And I would see all these famous faces, and I was like, wow. After it stopped, I stood up at the bars. I said, I wonder what that meant. I said, man, I said, I'm finna go home and be famous. I'm finna go home and be a rapper. I'm gonna be famous. That's what I thought it meant. And it's years later, I was standing up in my office one day, and I have all these pictures on the wall in my office. And I turned around and looked at every picture. And then I say, wait a minute. I say, these are all the people I seen when I was in that prison cell that I say, that was a vision. And you know what? I started to thank God. I say, God, I say, it might took me a long time to realize that you gave me a vision in that cell, but I see it. You took me amongst all the stars. It didn't mean that I was going to be famous, but you took me amongst all the stars. And that same voice that always comes to me came back. That voice say the only reason that you're not a star is that you never look at yourself in the picture. You're always looking at who you're taking the picture with. Your work has took you amongst those people. Your work took you to T.D. Jakes. Your work took you to Bishop Farrakhan. Your work took you to Dick Gregory. Your work took you to all of these people. It was your work. But start seeing yourself in the picture. That's our problem, that we don't see ourselves in the picture. And when we do look at pictures that we're in, we're either shown as a slave or a prisoner or a drug dealer. We have to disconnect ourselves from all of the things that the world has created to show us success. I mean, one of the biggest things that I see and find right now are youngsters that's trying to live a lifestyle that they've seen inside of these rap videos, and they're killing each other in the streets thinking that's going to get them on in the music industry. And the people that's running the music industry are not trying to stop it, because while they give them $1 or $2 million, they're making billions of dollars off of the foolishness. We have to disconnect ourselves from that. And we have to see more lawyers, more judges, more doctors. We barely see an individual going into these fields as colored people anymore, because we've been taught now that rap and basketball and football is the only way to become rich. And at the end of the day, you don't even have to be rich, brother. I travel the world every single day. And sometimes I do get the mindset, oh, I ain't got $1 million in the bank. But God will come right back and say, where is it that you need to go that you don't go? What is it that you want that you don't have? You have a nice home. You have a nice car. So it don't have to be in the bank. It could be in the world, and it will come to you because you're working for me. So that's the way that we have to start looking. But we have to start creating our own jobs when we come out of prison and make sure that we stick to that course. I mean, the main thing is when we come out of prison, we want to party instead of go to work. Now, you just had somebody working you for free, but now you don't want to work on your own. So you have to go out there, and I tell brothers, man, a guy was laughing at me when I first came home, and some of the things that I was doing, you know, one of my arch enemies, man, that used to be the man. Look at him now. I was down the corner with 2 apples and a banana in a bag. And I was telling them, you know, I would say, hey, I look at this as the same way I looked at the dope game. If I stood on the corner selling a $20 lot, I'm selling this bag of fruit for $3, and I sell 150 bags every morning. So you do the math on that. That's better than going to talking about how much I'm getting paid and pick up a $300 or $400 check at the end of the week. I'm waking more than that in one day. You know what I'm saying?
That's right.
In your mind of hustling. So when you see the brothers out there selling fruit, support those brothers, man, because they make good money. You know, but you got people that so they're so programmed into being a slave. So when they see you out there selling the fruit, you know what they say? Man, look at him out there trying to sell fruit. He needs to get a job. That is a job. You know?
That's right.
You know? Yeah, it is a job, man. But one of the stories that I just want to share, and this is just for laughter, brother, is that I was incarcerated in Los Angeles, and there was an old guy in there. He was a panhandler, you know? And he came in the cell, and I was like, man, what you in here for? Man, they brought me in here for panhandling. And he said, you know, he say, man, it's rough out there being a panhandler. I say, I know. He say, man, I walked up to a limousine, and he say, when the window came down, it was Prince. And he say, Prince gave him a $100 bill, and he say, he was thanking him. Thank you so much, thank you so much. And he say, the woman that was in the car with Prince say, why don't you get a job? And he say, he told her, why don't you get out here in this hot ass sun and be anxious for a job that I'm doing? You know what I'm saying? So it's all about your mentality. And when you think about it, bro, standing out there, man, begging for money is a job, man. So,
that's a
job. Yeah, it's a mentality thing, man. So,
oh, man.
Yeah. So, you know.
Oh, my God, that is phenomenal.
God, man, God has blessed me, man. I've traveled many places, man. And one of the things, I'm helping you along on this, man, because I don't want you to miss this. Being in prison, spending a lot of time in prison, former gang member, and all of that, man, to be working with the number one civil rights attorney in the nation has been one of my best things that God has blessed me with at this time. You know? So,
yes.
And people, you know, I'm speaking of being crumb.
That's right.
Have to
salute my man right there.
Yeah, man. But I want people, because I know you got some listeners out there, and there's a wave of us, you know. One thing about us as a people is that we would tear down a foundation without having another plan to build anything. And a lot of people are saying, well, this guy, he's everywhere. He's doing all these cases. None of these police officers are getting convicted. I have to explain to people all the time, brother. He's a civil rights attorney. A civil rights attorney is not a prosecutor. So a civil rights attorney can't charge a police officer with anything. Neither can a civil rights attorney go in court and prosecute them. That's the prosecutor job. So the person that you hired or the person that you went in and voted for DA, attorney general,
mm-hmm.
or state attorney general, those are the people that has the power to prosecute. So not being corrupt. Being corrupt job is to go get the bag. And for every case that he has handled, even the historical George Floyd case, $27 million, Georgia McClain case just got $10 million. Breonna Taylor, $12 million. He's won all of these cases. So his job is to go secure the bag for the family, because in some of these cases, economic justice is the only justice that we will see. And we have to pleased with him being able to accomplish those things, man, on the level that he has. So I've been working with him, man. It's been a joy working with him, man. And I just want our people to realize, man, that, you know, we go out, brother, and you see these protests and you see us out there as activists. I always tell people now, there's activists and there's actors. And I'm trying to make sure I don't become one of the actors that's out there. So when I say
that's
I mean there's activists that's out for the cause, that's not worrying about money. That's where I'm at. But there are actors that's getting money to get out there and just bring a lot of noise, and then they disappear into the night with a check, and the movement becomes lost. We're trying to keep the movement and save the movement from being lost by so many paid actors, man. So there's activists and there's actors, you know. So we're trying to keep the movement from falling into the hands of the actors right now. And that's one fight, man. That's a hell of a fight. And it's a very thin line to walk, you know, because it's easy for individuals to come to you with a large check. But that's why you see so many cities and states being held accountable for the actions that they have taken to allow these reckless police to kill. And at the end of the day, you know, we have to be wise about You know, I tell people I just get so disappointed in us sometimes. How can some of the smartest people be some of the dumbest people at the same time? When we sit back and say,
that's right.
I don't see how they getting away with it. No, I don't see how they been getting away with it this long. This been happening.
That's
you
right.
Know, everybody acting like this is new. This isn't new. Yes, it's on the news, but
new.
The damn show ain't new. They've been killing black folks, and we got to be
that's
strong
right.
enough to say that, man, and walk in there. And even if, let me tell you, even if your damn voice trembling when you say it, be bold enough to say it. That's how I am. I walk in there.
That's right,
know,
that's right.
And then you were talking about when I went into the city council meeting, and I told them, I said, look, the Lord didn't even get a piss on your Confederacy today. You know, and
woo!
They turn red because they ain't never had a black man stand up and tell them that in no red state. They looking at me crazy. And, you know,
man,
boy,
you said that. I was like, no, he didn't. Like, wow.
Say, man, let me tell you this. And this is a true story, bro. When I walked out of there, I felt like Superman. The little kids was asking to take pictures with me, and I felt like Superman, bro. I went over to a friend of mine's house. That's, you know, he's a gang leader, and, you know, I just went over there to kick it with him for a little while. I go in the hood and kick it, you know. And I went out there, I rung the doorbell, and, you know, his wife said, he's coming. So I'm sitting on the steps, and he came to the door. And he had seen the city council meeting. So I'm sitting there, you know, and I'm feeling good. And he studies when he talks. And he said, man, what you came around my house for? I said, what you mean? Man, you heard what you said on that damn TV about you pissing on the Confederate. Them white folks going to kill you. Get out of my boat. And he was serious. You're going to get killed. All the stuff that you came through, you're going to make them white folks kill you. Quit messing with them white folks. That's how we think, bro. We are so afraid of white people. We will kill each other, man. We'll kill each other just for looking at each other. And I tell people,
man,
because the movement is real. The movement is strong. Right now, let me tell you this, man. We go, and when a police officer shoots somebody, we go to the state capitol, we go to the White House, we go to all these different places to demand justice. And the cry that we're using right now, the hashtag, Black Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter. I like that. But listen, black lives have to matter to black people first. So if we can say it in front of the White House, we got to say it in front of the smack house. If we can say it in front of
that's
the White
right.
House, we got to say it in front of the crack house. We can't just let Black Lives Matter be a hashtag. It has to become a way of living for us. It has to become a cultural change for us. So if Black Lives really matter, let it start matter to black people first, and then everybody else will have to respect it. If not, we're just a bunch of damn hypocrites.
There we go. Now, man, listen, I'm enjoying this conversation, man, and this whole interview. You know, now, for the sake of time, you know, we got about a minute or two. I want to ask you real quick. I know you have an upcoming documentary coming up on Netflix. Can you kind of, you know, let people know a little bit about it, or are you allowed to, you know, when it's coming out?
I got, well, we got two documentaries. We got the one with me and Ben Crump that's going to be coming out in February during Black History Month, and that's going to cover the whole, everything that's been happening with the police killings and how things been happening. You know, it's going to cover all of that. The next documentary that's my documentary is called When It's the Tables Were Turned. And the thing that we're doing in that is we cover the story of George Floyd. We cover the story of Breonna Taylor, other individuals that was killed. And we're asking them, what if this was a white person? You know, would it be handled the same way? If it was a white person, would you let them walk away like this? So If the Tables Were Turned is the documentary that I'm working on. And I have a new book that's going to be coming out called Fight For You. And it's just going to be covering some of the things that I've done in my lifestyle and how God has changed me to be the individual that I am today, man. I enjoyed the show, though, man.
Just real quick, man. You know, is there anything, you know, first of all, is there any way people can contact you? Any information or social media or contact information, people can contact you if need be?
I'm Silky Slim 100 on Instagram. I'm Silky Slim on Facebook. I'm Silky Slim 100 on Twitter. You can go to my website, www.stoptheinc.org. Man, and why I say, man, let me tell you, I know God just hit me with this, man. Somewhere out there, there's a listener, somewhere out there, or a family member out there that's going through that suicidal thing, man. Listen, life is worth living. I can tell you that. I tried suicide 3 times, And God kept me here for a reason, man. So listen, don't do it. Seek help, because it's definitely a life is worth living. I can just tell them that. That's what somebody out there.
Yeah, definitely, brother. And I appreciate you. You know, the jewels that you're giving us, brother. But ladies and gentlemen, you know, I just want to say thank you for listening to my brother. I'm going to call you my brother because you are, you know, Arthur Silky Slim Reed. We want to say thank you, brother. It's been phenomenal just talking to you and catching up with you, man. And, it's been fun. I mean, I enjoyed it. I ain't going to lie. I had a good time, man. And, you know.
I know I did, man. And believe one thing, man. Simone is one of the few people that could have made this happen, because right now I'm in the midst of a conference, Trayvon Martin's Foundation, Mother of Circles conference, and I stepped out of that to do this interview, but I definitely enjoyed this interview, man, and I thank y'all for having me on, man. Anytime y'all need me, hit me up, man. Thank you so much, okay?
No doubt, but listen, you enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you.
Again, everybody, I want to say thank you for tuning in, and we enjoy just having this great brother with us. You know, my closing remarks, I'm going to leave it here. People who want to be blessed, but who are those they are blessing through their works? That's a question, an open-ended question. Ask yourself, you want to be blessed, but who are those you blessing, you know, through your works? So let's keep that in mind. You know, those want to, like my man said, those, everybody wants the crown, but they flee from the cross. So again, God bless everybody. Stay blessed, stay favored. You know, your vision has to come with action. It's the Unconcealed Talk Show. Yours truly, Naz, and of course, Rebirth, PR Media, and Shadow Worlds. God bless everyone. Have a good one.